From NPR and WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now, and in South Carolina today, it is finally a sunny day, but people in the state are rebuilding and mopping up after historic flooding that's gone on through the weekend.
Yeah, and Jeremy, as you know, 11 people are reported dead in weather-related incidents in South Carolina, and some places in the state saw nearly 2 feet of rain. Forest Acres, not far from the state capital of Columbia, is one of those places. Here's Mayor Frank Brunson.
20 inches of rain here falling in 3 or 4 days, and in some areas it got that amount of used to 40 inches of rain in a year.
Well, the situation in his city was made worse yesterday when dams breached, sending more water into already soaked places. And when I spoke with Mayor Brunson a little earlier, I asked him what his city looks like right now.
Well, a lot of the water has receded, but there's just evidence of so much property damage and roadway destruction and bridges being washed out. We do have a couple of good strong dams still left, but we're just sort of waiting and seeing what will happen as some of these other upstream dams start having problems with overflow.
Are any of the other dams at risk?
Well, they're all at risk. We're just sort of on standby to see. We don't know what's going to be coming in from the north where all the mountain areas are. We know drainage from those areas. That'll take a day or two for that water to impact us, but fortunately, we think we're in pretty good shape right now, but everything's at risk, and we're just sort of on standby, watching and waiting.
Yeah, I mean, I hear the phone ringing in your office. I imagine that people are trying to call a lot to let you know how they're doing or things that they need. How are the people of Forest Acres coping?
We have water up in homes up into the six or eight feet in their homes. We've had businesses flooded up same height. We're sort of creeping around, people reaching out to each other. We've got the National Guard here. We've got lots and lots of volunteers. And the people, we have a very strong community of about just under 11,000 folks. And in the surrounding area with Columbia and all the other surrounding municipalities are all reaching out to each other. So we'll get through it. It's going to be tough. A lot of rebuilding to do. But there's just massive devastation. People don't have cars to don't have places to go to work, number one, and then not sure how they would get there because the cars are flooded, homes flooded, businesses wrecked. It's chaos. You don't see that here in South Carolina unless we're talking coastal hurricanes and things, but this type of stuff inland for us is an event we're just we had enough preparation for it where we were able to deal with it. We've had unfortunate loss of life, but we're going to be digging out of the mud here soon.
Well, tell me, you mentioned Columbia, and I'm seeing that residents there either still don't have water to drink or they have to boil it. Do you have that same problem in Forest Acres?
Yes, we are under a boil water advisory. We get our water from the city of Columbia, so that's why we're affected by whatever problems they're having. We're going to have the same ones.
And finally, Mr. Mayor, I mean, you mentioned that this isn't something that you see very often inland. And even though you had a couple days' notice that times were going to be tough, I'm also seeing reports about how some people are saying that investment in infrastructure has been lacking. And that might have been one of the reasons why things are so bad right now. I mean, we're talking about dams getting breached. Is that what you see?
I don't know how you can prepare for under 100-year flood guidelines when we had what people are sort of saying there's a 500-year flood. There was no anticipation. No one in forward thinking, as everyone is, could ever imagine that this type of water impact could hit anywhere. No one thinks about this.
Do you have a sense as to how long it might be before everyone gets back up on their feet?
I think our priority right now is to make sure that everybody's safe. We do have, like I say, pending issues with some of these upstream dams and lakes being compromised. We're going to then have to get roadways put back into shape. All these bridges are going to have to be inspected. So to answer your question directly, I think it'll be a step-by-step thing, and once we get through the safety issue and the red zone, so to speak, where we don't think we've got any more water coming, then the digging out and the rebuilding will certainly start, and it'll take, I'm afraid, probably years to recover from all of this.
Well, Frank Brunson is mayor of the city of Forest Acres, South Carolina. Mayor Brunson, thank you so much, and we're all pulling for you. Thanks again.
Your thoughts and prayers. prayers are appreciated, and we please keep us in your hearts.
Thank you very much.
Just incredible there in South Carolina. And USA Today reporting, we've been calling this a 1-in-1,000-year rain event. USA Today reporting, this is the 6th so-called 1-in-1,000-year rain event in the U.S. just since 2010. We'll continue to follow that. But there was also big news in the world of science today. The Nobel Prize in Physics went to Takaki Kajita of Japan and Arthur MacDonald of Canada for discovering that subatomic particles called neutrinos have mass. Joining us to explain is Michael Turner, director of the Kavli Institute for Cosmological Physics at the University of Chicago. Professor, welcome.
Glad to be here, Jeremy.
Well, and tell us about the magnitude of this discovery, that neutrinos have mass. How big of a deal is that?
I think it's a pretty big deal. Neutrinos have a great deal of influence on the universe and our understanding of elementary particles. You know, they're called lightweights, but if there were ever an example of a lightweight punching above weight, it really is the neutrino.
Why? What are they exactly?
The neutrinos are the partners of electrons. And what's amazing, we all know the electron, and electrons are key to atoms and chemistry and all of that. And the neutrinos are just like electrons, but they don't have any charge. And so that changes the whole story. It means they can't form atoms. It means they're very hard to detect. It means that trillions of them pass through us without our knowledge. And so they're called ghostly, they're called elusive, but they're really important.
And up until this discovery, scientists believed that neutrinos had no mass.
That's right. So we knew that they were very, very light, you know, less than a millionth the mass of the electron, which is the lightest particle. And so the working assumption is, well, maybe they're massless. And having even this tiny, tiny little mass just changes the whole story.
And does what for our understanding of the universe, for example? What does it tell us about the big picture?
Many things about the big picture. Let me start with how much they contribute to the mass budget of the universe. Even though they have a tiny little mass, the universe has so many neutrinos that they contribute as much to the mass budget of the universe as do the stars that we see in the sky. They also tell us that the particle physicists who put together this amazing model of how the world works, called the Standard Model, it explains quarks to chemistry and beyond, is incomplete, because in that model of the basic particles and forces, neutrinos are supposed to be massless. And so even having this tiny little mass tells us that there's more to understand. Neutrinos also help, well, they're the mechanism by which the massive stars in the universe explode, cook the heaviest elements that are essential to life, and disperse them through the universe. So the neutrino is a particle that really does punch above its weight.
It's interesting because yesterday we had the Nobel Prize in Medicine, and it was very clear what the result of the research was, that the people who won it had helped to solve some of the world's parasitic diseases. With this one, it's not so concrete. It's still very complex, and we aren't exactly sure what this is going to mean going forward, are we?
So this is more the beginning than the end. So I think yesterday's prize was more about the end. We can solve these two diseases. This is more about the beginning. So for example, one of the big questions that we're trying to answer, and there's a few hints in this direction, is there may be other particles like the neutrino that are very important to how structure forms in the universe. They're called sterile neutrinos. Another thing that we would like to understand is the origin of ordinary matter, the atoms that you and I are made out of. We believe that neutrinos in the early universe had a role in creating the ordinary matter that we're made out of. So I think this really is the beginning of a story. The Fermi Lab, which is just 30 miles from where I am in Chicago, has a big, big neutrino program to study the properties of neutrinos by shooting neutrinos to Homestake and the Homestake mine in South Dakota. So I think you're right. This is more the beginning than the end.
And I understand we have to update a poem from John Updike as a result of this. The first lines of the poem read, "Neutrinos, they are very small. They have no charge and have no mass and do not interact at all. Now we know, not true."
Not true. So we always knew that they interacted a little bit, but John is a poet, so we give him poetic license. And they certainly have no charge. That's what I said earlier. But they do have mass, and that's a really big deal. And there you go. I mean, Cosmic Gall by John Updike. John Updike's favorite particle, the neutrino. And, you know, by the way, the other interesting thing, this little lightweight, this is its third Nobel Prize. So this particle, which is very, very shy, very, very hard to detect, it requires enormous detectors, gives us an exquisite window to how the universe and how the world of elementary particle physics works.
The little subatomic particle that could and did have mass. Michael Turner, director of the Kavli Institute for Cosmological Physics at the University of Chicago, joining us to talk about today's announcement about the Nobel Prize in Physics. Michael Turner, thank you.
You're welcome, Jeremy.
Roseburg, Oregon is beginning the slow road to healing following last week's mass shooting at Umpqua Community College. And that road is a familiar one for our next guest. 3 years ago, Caitlin Roig DeBellis was teaching her first graders at Sandy Hook Elementary School in Newtown, Connecticut, when 20-year-old Adam Lanza entered the school and shot and killed 20 kids and 6 adults. In the years that have followed, Caitlin has rebuilt her life. She got married, became a motivational speaker, and founded the nonprofit organization Classes for Classes. And she's written a new book. It's called Choosing Hope, Moving Forward from Life's Darkest Hours, and it comes out today. Caitlin Roig DeBellis joins us from New York. Welcome.
I'm so grateful to be here.
And it's great to have you. We were going to have you on anyway, but now that we're talking just days after this terrible attack in Oregon, your thoughts on that? When you see an attack like that, do you feel numb to it, as President Obama says, or because you've been through something like this, is it different for you?
I absolutely do not feel numb to it. The pain, unfortunately, is very close to my heart. My heart goes out to that community, to the victims, to their families. It's just awful.
And do you feel like it could have been avoided if something was done after Sandy Hook?
I'm so grateful that in our nation right now we're having the discussion, and that those conversations are being had, because they are so important and truly crucial. You know, as a teacher, though, my expertise in knowing what the answer is or what should be done, you know, my focus is on making sure that kids are successful. That's what I know how to do.
But as someone who's gone through something like this, you must have thought to yourself, there might be something that could be done to avoid something like this happening again.
Well, I hope that we are taking all the steps to make our country a safer place.
Well, of course, you have every right to you know, not take a political position on something that's obviously a very big controversy in this country about what should be done. But some listeners may wonder why you haven't after all that you've been through.
Oh, well, I think I absolutely did. I think it's very clear that when I say that I'm grateful it's being discussed on the platform it is and that something needs to be done, it's clear that I'm saying that there is a problem and something needs to be done. Where I draw the line is thinking that I'm the expert in knowing what that is or how it should be solved, because I'm certainly not.
But that's in terms of more gun control, for example, are you in favor of that?
I'm in favor of smart gun sense. I am in favor of awareness and of working very hard to change that climate.
We'll take us back to your experience, as you do in this book, and it is really unbelievable to read about it. But let's go back to that day, December 14th, 2012. It started out for you as a normal school day, but very quickly you realized something was wrong.
Yes, my classroom was the first in the school. So at around 9:30 in the morning, my kids and I were sitting in our morning meeting, as we do every day. We had just greeted one another and just finished listening to the Oklahoma version of Oh, What a Beautiful Morning, when very loud, rapid fire shots began over and over and over. My class was feet from where this was happening, and so I knew immediately that we were in imminent danger and that time was of the essence and that our chance at survival was hiding.
And you gathered up children and took them into a bathroom.
We raced to the back of our room, and we just started piling in.
How many were in there?
I had 16 students in 2012. 15 were present, so 16 with me.
And this is not a large bathroom, by the way. Very small one.
No, it is. Until that day, I had never stepped foot inside of it. It was probably 3 by 4 foot space with a toilet in the center. Very, very tiny.
And did you feel like you and the children would be safe in there?
I hoped we would, but no, I didn't ever think that we would get out of that bathroom based on our proximity to what we were hearing.
What did you tell them in there?
Well, there wasn't a ton of talking because obviously noise meant that evil could come closer to us. So we did remain very quiet, but I did not want what they were hearing in that hallway and on the other side of our classroom wall to be the last thing they heard. So I told them that I was so grateful to be their teacher, how lucky I was to have them in my class, and that I loved them very much. I mean, I had to step in there in that moment and make sure that they heard something loving.
And by the way, when people came to the door, you wouldn't let anyone in, even if they slipped an ID underneath.
No. No, not after what we heard. There was no way that I was going to just open a door. Truly, I did not believe that it was a real police badge. And so I said, I'm aware that you've been in our school for a while now and that you should have the keys or can find them. And they did have the master keys, and they tried, 7, 8 different ones. And eventually the door unlocked.
What did you do after that attack? I mean, how do you wake up the next morning and go about your life?
Oh, it was awful. It was awful for days. And what happened was, after living in that state for a couple of weeks of not being able to go in public, not a gas station, not a grocery store, not being able to be home alone, not being able to be in the dark, it was really incredibly infuriating. At the same time, I was very much trying to answer the whys. Why did this happen? Why our school? And what I came to find was that I was never going to answer those whys, not then, not now, not ever, and that instead I needed to focus my energy on questions that could be answered. And for myself, there were two. How do I make sure this day does not define my students and myself? And the second was, how do we get our control back? Because it was taken from us on that day. And those two questions led me on my path of healing. I say all the time, I will never move on from December 14th, but every day I will move forward. And I think that's a really important distinction for anyone going through a really hard time.
Explain that distinction between moving on and moving forward.
Of course. You don't have to move on from your hard time. It is wholly a part of you. It happened to you. You can, grieve it, mourn it, be sad about it, cry when, you're moved to and feel those emotions. And to know that that's okay, but at the same time, to make a conscious effort that you're always moving forward with purpose.
How did you start teaching your students again? Because one of the things you talk about is that their attention spans were gone. Lessons you taught at the beginning had gone. It almost sounds like PTSD among the class.
Well, it was very much like going back to the beginning of the school year. We were in a brand new space. What they had heard and experienced on that day was horrible and very different than, others' experience. They were so aware that our survival was because we had a hiding place in our room. And now we were in a new space with nowhere to hide. And my students would ask me, every day, Ms. Roy, what if a bad guy comes? Ms. Roy, what would we do? Where would we hide? And I couldn't answer that question for them. For me, after what my kids lived through, my utmost and only concern was them being okay and feeling okay. And that's what I advocated for.
Well, you also had this idea, which was that all these donations that were pouring into your school from all over the country, you could take those donations and help another classroom.
Yeah, so it was this real light bulb moment after giving and giving to my kids for a week or two. As their teacher, I realized that if I did not take the teachable moment to teach them that in life, when you get, you have to give, that I would be completely missing the mark. And I brought a box in front of them one day and started pulling objects out. And I posed the question, why did somebody do this for us? And immediately they said they wanted to be kind. They wanted to be nice. And I said, you're absolutely right. And what should we do when somebody's nice and kind to us? And they said, well, we should be nice to someone else. We should be kind. And I said, you're absolutely right. And then I didn't pose a question, but the most incredible thing happened. Their hands started to raise again. And they said, who are we going to help? How are we going to help them? What are we going to give? And it was this moment of my kids. Here we are 3 weeks after the worst day of our lives and many people's lives. They were able to feel pure joy. And they were able to have smiles on their faces and to feel excited about giving to someone else. And that was the moment that I realized, okay, all kids need this. All kids need to be able to experience giving freely. All kids need to be able to experience that in life we're all connected. And so that was the night that I went home and I just started Googling around and discovered that there was nothing else like it out there. And I thought, well, there needs to be.
How are your former students doing now?
Well, you know, you can't answer any statement as a blanket statement for sure. I can't say, oh, they're all great or, oh, they're all terrible. You know, I think healing is a process. And certainly there are peaks and valleys. I am so incredibly grateful that I get to keep in touch with my students and their families. I saw almost all of my students this past December, and I saw a few of my students 2 weeks ago. And I'm just so grateful that I get to continue to be a part of their lives and to see them, you know, move forward and flourish as now fourth graders. It's such a gift.
And what would your advice be to the people in Umpqua Community College out in Roseburg, Oregon, as they now pick up the pieces after what happened last week?
Oh, that's so hard. I think remembering that it really is a process and that what seems insurmountable now, having really truly been there, doesn't have to be, really does not have to be. And, you know, the path to healing is a long one, and just, you know, certainly my thoughts and prayers are with each of them as they, you know, work to do that.
That's Caitlin Roig-DeBellis. Her new book is called Choosing Hope, Moving Forward from Life's Darkest Hours. And as we said, she's a former Sandy Hook first grade teacher. Caitlin, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Scandal, charges of insider trading, allegations of leaked documents, and billions of dollars at stake. And we're talking about fantasy sports, specifically two companies that are trying to move fantasy sports into the mainstream, DraftKings and FanDuel. And all this after an employee at DraftKings admitted to accidentally posting confidential data last week, and then that same employee also happened to make $350,000 at the rival betting site FanDuel. WBUR's Kurt Nickisch joins us now in the studio to explain. Hi there, Kurt.
Hey, Meghna.
Okay, so Kurt, so the website Daily Fantasy Sports Report first pointed out this error from the DraftKings employee, but why is all this being called insider trading?
Well, it's being called insider trading because it's almost like these are stock exchanges, except rival stock exchanges that are trading exactly the same stock. So what this employee did was posted information that gave insight into how professional sports players, how popular they were in fantasy lineups. And of course, you know, this is where people put together make-believe rosters of actual players. And if your fantasy roster outplays another fantasy roster, then you win. So knowing roughly, you know, how many people like certain players can be kind of valuable. And so that's what makes it akin to insider trading. Now, DraftKings says that that employee did not have that information in time to change his roster, but the coincidence with his jackpot is what is raising flags.
Yeah, and as we said, $350,000. And in a statement, FanDuel and DraftKings said there's no evidence, right, that the employee misused any information. But is it common for employees of these companies to bet on rival sites?
It is common, or at least it was until now. Employees of these companies have won prize money at rival sites. And, you know, a lot of people work at FanDuel and DraftKings because they were fans of fantasy sports in the first place, including DraftKings founder Jason Robbins. I talked to him before this scandal broke, and I asked him to explain how daily fantasy wagers are not like gambling. And here's how he explained it.
It's all based around research, knowledge, being able to have an intuition and really understand, you know, what the matchups are going to be like, what the coach's game plan is likely to be, which players are poised for a breakout. People that are good at that are able to win at a high rate.
So it's clear that knowledge is valuable. And, you know, if you know that out of the thousands of entries at your company that a certain player is statistically undervalued, you know, you can use that information over at a rival company to increase your chances of winning. But the two companies have put an end to that for now. They've banned their workers from playing daily fantasy sports for money at other websites, not just the ones they work at.
Okay, so there's a gray area in the regulation of these sites, Kurt, because of course betting on pro sports is illegal in most states, but these companies have relationships with some professional sports teams. So what's going on?
Yeah, leagues and TV broadcasters and owners of these sports teams have welcomed fantasy sports because it makes their games and their broadcasts more exciting for fans. Not, you know, they don't just want to watch their home team. The owners of the Dallas Cowboys and the New England Patriots, they've invested in these companies. They're part owners. ESPN, Fox, and NBC have marketing deals. And that's all based on current protection under federal law that these are games of skill and don't need to be regulated by like gambling. Now, some states disagree, but this scandal definitely makes the industry look more shady, more like Las Vegas, no offense, Las Vegas, and that's only going to invite regulation and oversight that these companies would rather do without.
This podcast is sponsored by Casper. Casper is an online retailer of premium mattresses made in America. They're engineered for comfort and long-lasting support by combining premium latex foam and memory foam. It's outrageous comfort at a polite price. Here's the great part. Pick the one that is best for you and try it out risk-free for 100 days with free delivery and returns. Go to casper.com/now and you can save $50. That's casper.com/now.
Revolutionary, in the truest sense of the word. That is how one critic describes the unique sound of the band Algiers.
Television coma, all my blood's in vain.
The band's fusion of gospel and punk, combined with lead singer Franklin James Fisher's grinding yet soulful vocals, produce what another ecstatic critic called a heady, vicious condemnation of bankrupt culture. As you can hear in this song, called Blood, off the band's self-titled debut album.
15 minutes of freedom. Still can fit so bad. Still relax your conscience. And disgrace your
Algiers' three members all hail from Atlanta. Though they've left Georgia, bassist Ryan Mahan says the South is a big cultural marker hanging over our heads. And the region remains a complicated source of inspiration for the band, as I found out when I talked to lead singer Franklin James Fisher about the origins of Algiers' unusual sound.
While I was teaching in France, increasingly I found out that people were had no idea about the history of slavery in America or African-American history. And those two things are inextricably bound to not only American history, but the history of the modern world. And so I started teaching a lot about African-American history, and in the process I became pretty, I guess for lack of a better term, I became Afrocentric within that year or so span. A lot of that turned into what would become Blood. It's definitely about exercising demons and having a constructive reaction to political oppression.
Yeah. I mean, and it's so, in the music, you can hear it. You can hear those demons trying to be, or you trying to exorcise those demons, because it's so raw and emotional and honest. And I want to hear a little bit more of that honesty. So let's listen to But She Was Not Flying. You wrote these songs before Ferguson, before the Black Lives Matter Matters movement, mm-hmm. right? Tell us a little bit more about that. I mean, in a way, it's like it feels like you could have written that song just yesterday.
Right. Yeah, unfortunately. Well, you know, the thing about the Black Lives Matter movement and Ferguson and Eric Garner and everything that's happened in the past year and a half, it's not new. It's something that's been happening for years and decades and centuries even. You try to find a way to deal with it and to cope with it in a manner that doesn't make you a victim insofar as perpetuating a cycle of violence. And the structure of the song is such that at the very beginning you're dealing with a very standard gospel form wherein you have a call and response talking about how things are going to be so much better in the afterlife on the promise that you do everything that you're supposed to do within that institution in order to get to the afterlife. But that's complicated. I come from a Baptist church background, and my family is very, very spiritual and very active in the church, and I am as well. Both sides of my parents, they're from the country in North Carolina. They would listen to this really great gospel music on the radio on Sunday morning, but we went to, for the first couple of years when I was growing up in the suburbs of Atlanta, we went to a predominantly white church, and it couldn't be any different from the music that I identified with.
I'd love to have us hear another song. It's got an interesting beginning to it. It's called In Parallax, and let's mm-hmm. listen.
Really say, take time and listen. Grandma used to tell us she didn't have a good education, but she had this God wisdom.
Sounds like some sort of voice recording or field recording at the beginning of that of the song. What is that? What is that?
And she said, take time sometime and listen at a dog bark. So he might be trying to warn me.
That's interesting. You're the first person to ask about that. That's my granddad. I was really close with him. We had the same birthday, actually. You know, I was as close with him, I think, as anybody could ever be with a grandparent. And he died when we were recording the record. It was rough and pretty sudden because he had his health all the way up to his last couple of days. Mm. Most of the time, you know, he would just play with us and he would be pretty laid back and make a lot of jokes. He was hilarious. But every now and again, he would just, everything would be quiet and he would just start talking. He would just lay some wisdom on you. And it got to the point where we would just start recording him.
Your voice in this song comes from I don't know where. Like, such a deep place. I mean, it just, like, makes your hair stand on edge hearing it.
I don't know. I think I'm just loud. I used to always get in trouble in school for talking, and you know, it took me years to figure out. It's not that I was talking more than the other kids. I was just louder than them, so the teachers always singled me out. And I guess I was able to just find something that I could channel that to my advantage. But no one's got the ceiling.
You know, you had mentioned earlier that you were in France and you were teaching in France, and that made mm-hmm. me think about the name of the band, Algiers. Mm-hmm. Why did you name the band Algiers? I mean, there's a long history between France and Algeria itself. Does it have something to do with that?
Well, definitely. You know, Ryan came up with the name of the band. And even before we were able to make any substantial music, he had this idea of wanting to make a place where we could bring all of our political influence and philosophical influences together with the music. We very much view music as a way of asserting resistance and defining things on our terms and defining things on the terms of people who have no voice and no other means of communicating. So I taste my soul sweet.
A report out today from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says U.S. hospitals are increasingly instituting measures to help new mothers learn how to breastfeed and how to stick with it even after they go home from the hospital. In 2007, 29% of hospitals followed a set of standards to encourage breastfeeding. The latest results show that more than half of U.S. hospitals now follow those guidelines. From Here and Now contributor KJZZ, Kate Sheehy, a breastfeeding mother herself, reports.
Sarah Hatton and her newborn baby boy are both in tears. Malachi was born with a tongue tie. That's when the cord connecting the tongue to the floor of the mouth is short and restricts mobility. He just had surgery to fix it, but now has to learn to suck.
Because he's not able to access her milk as efficiently as he needs to, he gets frustrated at the breast.
Chrissy Blake is a registered nurse and an international board-certified lactation consultant. She's also co-owner of Milk and Honey, a new breastfeeding support center in Tucson, Arizona. Blake shows Hatton how to use a supplemental nursing system. The baby drinks from a tiny tube attached to a bottle with formula or breast milk that's been pumped, while at the same time feeding at the breast.
So he's still getting your breast milk. He's getting a little bit more flow, and he's getting additional calories here, which will help kind of increase his weight gain a little bit while still stimulating your supply. Is it okay?
Yeah.
Okay.
It's just hard.
Yeah, I know.
The American Academy of Pediatrics recommends that babies be exclusively breastfed for about the first 6 months. CDC studies show that breastfed babies have a lower risk of getting asthma and intestinal infections, among other conditions. And moms who breastfeed have a lower risk for breast and ovarian cancers and heart disease.
Breastfeeding is really about supply and demand, and you have to sort of immediately start creating that demand and actually breastfeeding the baby so that then the milk supply will follow.
Kriya Perine heads the infant feeding team at the CDC. In a report out today, the agency looks at breastfeeding support in hospitals. The data is from a survey of successful breastfeeding practices established by the World Health Organization and the United Nations Children's Fund. The CDC started the survey in 2007, sending it out to every birth facility in the country every 2 years. More than 80% have responded.
We know that a lot of women stop breastfeeding before they intend. And so that's where I think these professionals are really key to helping women starting breastfeeding.
Perine says hospitals have improved in several areas, such as initiating breastfeeding and keeping moms and babies together longer after delivery. But that support drops significantly after the moms leave the hospital.
I just don't feel like I'm making as much. And I used to be able to pump, 6 to 10 ounces in 10 minutes, and now...
This is a weekly free breastfeeding support group at Tucson Medical Center. Over the last few years, the hospital has been implementing more breastfeeding-friendly practices, such as using formula only when medically necessary. And within the last few weeks, it's opened an outpatient breastfeeding clinic.
Because it's so frustrating to talk to them over the phone, and then you call them a day later, and things still haven't changed. And you know that if you could look at the latch, if you could just look at it, you could come up with different things that could help them.
Noreen Carver is a lactation consultant at the hospital, and the latch she's talking about is the way a baby's mouth connects to the mom's nipple in order to effectively get milk. Carver says now she'll be able to see more moms one-on-one. There's even financial assistance for women who have to pay out of pocket.
It used to be that you'd have your aunt, your grandma, your cousin, your sister to help you through breastfeeding in the beginning, but we don't have that infrastructure for breastfeeding at all. So I see us as that.
It's what it is. It's a little bottle that has a tiny little tube,
Back at Milk and Honey, co-owner Nina Isaac says breastfeeding may not work for every mom, and she says women don't need to feel ashamed if they choose formula.
We need to give informed consent. We need to give all the information. These are your options. You can pump your milk, or there's formula if you need it. It's there. It's not a bad word. It saved many a baby's lives.
In that first week as a new mom, getting up every few hours to breastfeed, I remember thinking, really? Can I do this? With the help of a lactation specialist, I found that it does get easier. I'm still breastfeeding my six-month-old. For Here and Now, I'm Kate Sheehy in Tucson.
Well, before we close out this hour, a note on a sea change at one of the world's largest companies, something customers have been asking for a long time, has finally happened.
Dear McDonald's, thank you for serving all-day breakfast. Heart emoji, everyone on earth.
Retweet.
Favorite your retweet.
It's time for hashtag all-day breakfast. Smiley tongue face emoji.
Today, for the first time, McDonald's breakfast is available after 10:30 in the morning in most locations. Now, interestingly, Meghna, there is what they're calling an egg McMuffin gap. Because of the way fast food chains cook their breakfast, the individual locations had to choose between McMuffins or biscuit sandwiches, and southern states from Louisiana to Virginia are going to be offering biscuits. McMuffins will be available all day in the rest of the country. One analyst suggests renaming the Mason-Dixon line the Biscuit McMuffin line.
I have to say I prefer biscuits, though.
I like the McMuffins.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now.